Picture Elon Musk's vision. A million people living on Mars within our lifetime, humanity spreading across the solar system like pioneers heading west. It's intoxicating stuff. But what if our most cherished space dreams rest on foundations as solid as Martian dust? This isn't another starry-eyed celebration of our cosmic destiny. Instead, it's a reckoning with what actually happens when human bodies, built by millions of years of Earth-bound evolution, confront environments that want them dead. The Wiener-Smiths spent 4 years excavating the buried assumptions beneath our space ambitions, transforming from enthusiastic supporters into what they call space bastards, skeptics armed with uncomfortable questions. Their conclusion challenges everything we've been told. Rushing to colonize space might create more nightmares than solutions, and the gap between SpaceX promotional videos and sustainable off-world living is wider than the gulf between Earth and Mars itself. Every great migration needs a story to justify the journey, and space settlement has collected several. The most seductive is the backup plan narrative, that Mars colonies would preserve humanity if Earth becomes uninhabitable. But pause for a moment and consider what this actually means. Even an Earth scourged by nuclear winter, choked by runaway climate change, or devastated by pandemic would remain vastly more hospitable than Mars on its best day. Mars offers no breathable air, no magnetic field to block radiation, and soil laced with toxic perchlorates. Any Mars settlement would require constant Earth resupply for generations, making it useless as actual insurance against terrestrial catastrophe. The environmental salvation pitch fares no better under scrutiny. To merely maintain Earth's current population, not reduce it, we'd need to relocate 220,000 people daily to space, every single day, forever. The industrial-scale infrastructure required makes current space programs look like toy rockets. And those dreams of mining asteroids for precious metals? The economics collapse when you calculate extraction costs against market value, especially since non-renewable resources constitute barely 2.5% of Earth's actual wealth. Perhaps most revealing is the overview effect myth, this idea that seeing Earth from space confers profound wisdom. Yet, after nearly 70 years of spaceflight and over 600 astronauts, their insights rarely transcend greeting card philosophy about Earth's beauty. Space systematically dismantles the human body. In microgravity, your skeleton becomes dead weight. Your body mines it for resources. After 4 months in orbit, astronauts lose about 1% of spine mass monthly. Calf muscles shrink by 13% despite rigorous exercise. Some never fully recover their bone density. Bodily fluids shift upward, creating puffy face bird leg syndrome, swollen faces atop stick-thin legs. This fluid redistribution increases intracranial pressure, potentially damaging vision permanently. About half of ISS crew members report significant vision problems, and recent evidence suggests lasting brain damage in regions controlling movement and cognition. Then there's radiation, the silent killer conventional shielding can't stop. Beyond Earth's magnetosphere, galactic cosmic radiation bombards every cell nucleus every few days, shredding DNA. A single solar flare can deliver a year's radiation exposure in hours. Current NASA standards limit astronauts to a 3% risk of exposure-induced death, potentially barring women and experienced astronauts from Mars missions. Most troubling is reproduction. Can humans reproduce safely in altered gravity? We have zero data. Limited animal studies suggest serious developmental problems in mammalian embryos exposed to microgravity. For genuine space settlement, we need proof that space babies can develop normally, a question no space program has seriously addressed. Surveying potential settlement locations means choosing between varieties of death. The moon offers what Buzz Aldrin termed magnificent desolation, carbon poor, water scarce, coated in electrostatically charged regolith that clings like toxic Velcro. Temperatures swing from -250°C to 120°C across 2 week cycles. Its sole advantage? Proximity, at 385,000 kilometers with 1 second communication delays, making rescue theoretically possible. Mars has perchlorates that destroy thyroid function and planet-engulfing dust storms. Most critically, it sits 6 months away, with no quick returns and communication delays stretching from 3 to 22 minutes. Any emergency becomes a death sentence. Giant rotating space stations could create artificial gravity, but require millions of tons of materials, 20,000 launches for a million-ton station. To avoid nausea, wheels must span 450 meters in diameter at 2 rotations per minute. Beyond these lie worse options: asteroids with limited solar power, Venus with 450C surfaces and sulfuric acid clouds, and the dark outer solar system. Creating miniature biospheres remains critical yet challenging. Biosphere 2 sealed 8 people in 3.14 acres for 2 years. They split into hostile factions and nearly starved, while microorganisms consumed oxygen and concrete absorbed CO2, nearly suffocating them. Yet they survived, proving closed systems can work despite fixable problems. Space settlement faces legal challenges as daunting as technical ones. The Outer Space Treaty forbids national sovereignty in space, extending to corporations under national jurisdictions. SpaceX can't claim Mars because corporate claims become national responsibilities. Yet nations can establish research stations with sovereign law applying within them, potentially monopolizing premium real estate like lunar peaks of eternal light, just 1/100th of a billionth of lunar area. While territorial sovereignty is prohibited, resource exploitation is permitted. The US, Japan, UAE, and Luxembourg have passed laws supporting private companies' rights to extract and sell space resources. The Artemis Accords introduce safety zones, designated areas around lunar activities restricting entry. When nations establish kilometer-wide safety zones around bases in valuable locations, the distinction from sovereignty becomes meaningless. Company towns in space create unprecedented power dynamics. On Earth, company towns controlled housing and employment. In space, corporations control entire life support systems, oxygen generation, water recycling, radiation protection. When a Mars CEO owns your oxygen and return transport costs millions, you can't quit when leaving means death or bankruptcy. History reveals structural problems regardless of intentions, whether capitalist Pullman, Illinois, or communist Norilsk. Even well-intentioned settlements face the omni-antagonist effect when your employer is simultaneously landlord, utility provider, healthcare system, and government. Minor grievances accumulate dangerously. Economic downturns pose existential threats, with 26-month launch windows and evacuation costs exceeding $100 million per person. For space settlements to survive, we need answers to 2 questions. How many humans prevent inbreeding, and how many maintain high-tech civilization without Earth? Early estimates of 80 to 150 people were wildly incorrect. Sophisticated models accounting for disasters suggest 10,000 effective population, around 30,000 actual people for just 5 generations. Technological workarounds like freeze-dried gametes or algorithm-controlled breeding might enable survival with 98 people, but will future generations accept this? The idea that Mars could achieve independence with 1 million people collapses under scrutiny. Earth's most isolated economies, Cuba and North Korea, struggle with self-sufficiency, despite larger populations and better conditions. Computer chip fabrication illustrates the challenge. Earth's 8 billion people rely on just 3 manufacturers, requiring massive infrastructure. A self-sufficient Mars colony would need either hundreds of millions transferred quickly or unimaginably advanced robotics. The verdict? There's no viable short-term backup plan in space. If we could build permanent bubble worlds for 1 million people on Mars, we could more easily solve Earth's environmental problems. The Plan B narrative distracts from protecting the only habitable planet we have. Space settlement isn't impossible. It's extraordinarily difficult, far beyond any terrestrial frontier. The right approach isn't abandoning the dream, but pursuing it with patience, scientific rigor, and ethical consideration. This means waiting for major developments before moving many settlers at once. The waiting period isn't idle. It involves developing robotic systems for the moon, researching reproduction through animal studies, determining minimum viable populations, and advancing fields from artificial wombs to international law. We need focused research on two critical tracks: biology, reproduction, and ecology, studying long-term effects of partial gravity, space reproduction, and sustainable closed ecosystems, and understanding how ecosystems function in unusual environments. The right space law already exists conceptually, something like the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, calibrated for major space powers, preventing territorial scrambles while enabling peaceful collaboration. Konstantin Tsiolkovsky wrote, "The Earth is the cradle of humanity, but one cannot forever live in the cradle." True, but what emerges from a cradle is a toddler, lacking knowledge, excitable, prone to self-destruction. Better to leave Earth as mature adults. If space settlement requires abandoning our moral frameworks regarding human life, what's the point? We must develop not just technical capabilities, but ethical frameworks, legal structures, and social systems making off-world communities worth living in, extensions of humanity's best qualities rather than isolated outposts where our worst tendencies flourish unchecked. The stars will still be there when we're ready. The question isn't whether we can reach them, but whether we'll be worthy of the journey.